On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we have Mr. Curtis Franklin and Mr. Brian McHenry here today. We discuss a cyber threat that could have poisoned the water supply of a Florida city. Pretty scary. We also have a good conversation about the SolarWinds attack and how it reinforces the concept of zero trust. Plus, we have Senior Manager of Corporate Strategy for AppDynamics, Trajan Sparek, and he's going to discuss the disparities between application and infrastructure teams and how to increase synergy and productivity between them. You shouldn't miss it. Twyatt on the set.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 430, recorded February 12th, 2021. Cloud Monitoring Mixology. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Worldwide Technology. Worldwide Technology's advanced technology centers like no other testing and research lab with more than $500 million of equipment, including OEMs like Dell Technologies, and it's virtual, so you can access it 24/7. To learn more and get insights into all that it offers, go to wwt.com/twit. And by Barracuda. Hackers are always looking for the weakest link in your security configuration, especially your email security. Barracuda's new threat analyzer tool helps you gain visibility into your particular vulnerabilities. Visit barracuda.com/enterprise. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I am your host, Louis Moreski, your guide through this big, giant world of the enterprise. But I can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professionals, the experts in their field. And we have not one but two security experts in the house today, starting with Mr. Brian McHenry. He's the Senior Director of Global Security Solutions at F5 Networks. Bam, it's always great to have you back on. How's things going in your neck of the woods?
Well, out here in New Jersey, lots of snow and more coming this weekend. From what I understand, this will be a snowy Valentine's Day as we, try to get a little date night in with the wife. And I'm really looking forward to that regardless, because we got a cool outdoor igloo spot that we're going to go to, and we'll have our own little space and still be able to get a date, but keep it safe with COVID conditions still reigning over the day.
Very nice. Well, the groundhog did see his shadow, so it seems like you guys are going to be a mess for a while, I think. We'll have to see. Good seeing you, Bam. Well, speaking of professionals, we have Mr. Curtis Franklin here today as well. He's a senior analyst at Omdia and a permanent resident of the Sunshine State. I'm going to guess there's no snow in your area. Is that correct, Curtis?
Well, we have no snow and no spot for a cool igloo. It's currently 82 degrees. I think an igloo would head straight into soggy. So I'm happy to be inside where the air conditioning is functional and the Twyatt company is always good.
Fantastic. And you're going to have a visit from... someone from the Paradise State, correct?
Yes. As a matter of fact, it could happen during this episode of Twyatt. My dear wife, the sainted Carol, has gone to the airport to pick up Brian and his lovely bride. And they might just make it back here before the episode is over. If so, we'll see if we can sneak in a cameo appearance.
Thank you, Curtis. Always great to have you here. Now, we've had quite the week in the enterprise and IT world. We're not only going to talk about a cyber threat that could have poisoned the water supply of a Florida city, pretty scary, but we also want to take you through SolarWinds and just how it reinforces the concept of zero trust. Plus, our guest today is going to take us through a relatable topic for a lot of organizations. We have Senior Manager of Corporate Strategy for AppDynamics, Trajan Sparek, and he's going to discuss the disparities between applications and infrastructure teams and just how to increase that synergy between those teams and how to make them more productive. But before we get into all that, let's go ahead and jump into this week's blips. Well, folks, it isn't an enterprise week without a leak. Now, this past week, Singapore telco Singtel says it's investigating the impact of a cybersecurity breach that may have compromised customer data. Now, the attack had affected a file sharing system developed two decades ago by a third-party vendor called Accelion. Now, the telco said that the tool was deployed as a standalone system and shared information within the organization and external stakeholders. Now, use of the system was removed, and relevant authorities were, including the Singapore Cybersecurity Agency and local police, were actually notified. Now, there's a bit of irony there. Now, Singtel added that it evaluated the nature of the impact of the breach and the extent of the data that might have been illegally accessed, and they believe that customer data was actually accessed. Now, the vendor, Accelion, said it was made aware of a zero-day vulnerability in mid-December, which then was the beginning of a combined cyber attack that continued in January 2021, now with further exploits identified after that. Now, it said it had released a fix for the initial exploit within 72 hours and continued to release patches to close each vulnerability discovered in the following weeks. Now, the vulnerabilities were limited to the FDA software and did not impact its enterprise content firewall product, Kiteworks. Now, according to Singtel, if leaked, the data could be useful to their competitors, which is scary for them. Now, the FDA system was used amongst employees and likely would include internal information such as business plans for them. Now, Accelion points out that their FTA system is over 20 years old, and it seems that this legacy system did not get as much attention as they'd hoped from their developers and security team as it should. You think? Now, I don't know about you, but running an organization means you also have to audit the systems you're using at least once a quarter. Now, in this day and age, if it ain't broke, audit it and upgrade it.
Well, ransomware attacks have begun to move much more heavily to target software applications, open source tools, and web and application frameworks as these attackers seek more direct paths to organizations' largest and most important data stores. RiskSense researchers reported that they detected 223 vulnerabilities associated with 125 ransomware families in 2020. That's a massive increase from their 2019 findings of 57 CVEs tied to 19 ransomware families. These attackers are diversifying their targets, moving up the stack to target software as a service applications and remote technology, a shift that shows how attackers are adapting as businesses move more of their operations to the cloud. Researchers noticed that 18 CVEs are tied to ransomware was found across WordPress, Apache Struts, Java, PHP, Drupal, and ASP.NET, all of which are major components of the web and application framework space. Open source and related projects are also targets. 19 CVEs were tied to ransomware, and those exist in Jenkins, MySQL, OpenStack, Tomcat, Elasticsearch, OpenShift, JBoss, and Nomad. Interestingly, nearly all, or 96% of the vulnerabilities used in ransomware attacks in 2020 were reported in the U.S. National Vulnerability Database before 2019. Of these, 120 were actively used in ransomware attacks that trended in the past 10 years, and 87 are currently trending through the 2018 to 2020 time span. The largest contributors in ransomware attacks are vulnerabilities disclosed in 2017, 2018, and 2019. So what should organizations do? They should defend against evolving ransomware threats by first understanding their exposure. Knowing where they are vulnerable, that's a first step in ransomware defense.
Rest in peace, CentOS. Last month, Red Hat caused a lot of consternation in the enthusiast and small business Linux world when it announced the discontinuation of CentOS Linux. Longstanding tradition and ambiguity in Red Hat's posted terms led users to believe that CentOS 8 would be available until 2029, just like the RHEL 8 it was based on. Red Hat's early termination of CentOS 8 in 2021 cut 8 of those 10 years away, leaving thousands of users stranded. Red Hat Enterprise Linux, however, is now available free for dev teams, and it's even free in production for up to 16 systems. Now, what is less clear and what may lurk in many of our listeners' IT infrastructure is how this will affect embedded systems such as network appliances and IoT devices, which rely on CentOS for the base of their systems. These IoT and IT manufacturers will need to select an alternate Linux kernel to support their device's platform. Enterprise IT administrators should double check with their technology vendors to ensure which Linux kernel they may be using and if they have plans to replace CentOS should it be in use in their solutions.
Well, this week we heard of another ransomware attack, and this time it was one that was targeting a game developer, a pretty well-known one as well, that CD Projekt Red, or CDPR, which is the developer of Cyberpunk 2077 and The Witcher 3, was hit hard with a cyber attack. Now, CDPR disclosed this past week that a ransomware attack involving source code extortion happened. That's right. The bad guys wanted to auction off the stolen source code for high-profile games produced by CDPR, including Cyberpunk 2077. Now, CDPR played the cool card and said that it had no intention of meeting the hackers' demands. Now, they didn't take care of that, and it meant that that stolen material from the hacker began circulating online. What happened next? Well, there's no honor amongst thieves. The hackers started to leak the legitimate source code information to online forums such as Xploit. Now, a security firm was able to download those examples to confirm the data was real, and so was that source code. Now, the stolen material also included internal documents, and though it's unclear what type of documents they were, additional material, what was in that cache, it was still internal documents. What is popular gaming source code worth? Well, the starting price of the auction was $1 million with higher bids in increments of $500,000 and a buy it now price of $7 million. Now, ensure buyers were serious. Only users who deposited 0.1 Bitcoin could actually participate. Now, the result? Someone actually won the auction and purchased the data and the source code. Now, I wonder what someone may do with $7 million worth of gaming code, but the most relevant thing they can do here is actually use it to find more exploits in the game code, like remote execution ones, and resell them for even more cash. Now, at this point, I'm more interested in what's to come next than actually CDPR's response.
A long-known implementation error in the TCP that network devices use to communicate with each other continues to persist in TCP IP stacks used in millions of IT, OT, and IoT devices. The vulnerabilities give attackers a way to hijack TCP connections, close them, spoof packets, bypass authentication, and inject data into network traffic. The flaws were discovered in 9 out of 11 TCP IP stacks recently analyzed by Forescout as part of a broader study in recent months of the communication protocol security. The vulnerabilities, the same across all 9 stacks, involve the manner in which the so-called initial sequence number, or ISN, is generated. This ISN ensures that every TCP connection is unique so that there are no collisions with other connections and that no third party can interfere with an ongoing connection. To guarantee this, the ISN is randomly generated so that no one can guess the number and use it to hijack an ongoing connection or spoof a new one. The problem has to do with code that was designed and implemented decades ago. Forescout's study involved 7 open-source TCP IP stacks, UIP, FNET, Pico TCP, NutNet, IWIP, Cyclone TCP, and UC TCP IP, and 4 from commercial vendors, MPLab.net from Microchip, Texas Instruments, NDK TCP IP, ARMS NanoStack, and Siemens NucleusNet. Last October, Forescout informed the vendors and maintainers of these stacks of the vulnerabilities it had discovered. Patches or mitigations have been issued for all the vulnerable stacks except for NutNet and UIP. In its report this week, Forescout pointed to several public use cases of the TCP/IP stacks that the company analyzed, including in medical devices, IT storage systems, wind turbine monitoring systems, and remote terminal units. The company says that organizations using devices with these stacks should consider employing encrypted connections and limiting exposure of the devices to the internet.
And the breach hits keep on coming as security firm Malwarebytes was breached by the same hackers who hit SolarWinds. Now, they said they were breached by the same nation-state-sponsored hackers who compromised a dozen or more U.S. government agencies and private companies via the compromise of SolarWinds. Now, the attackers are best known for first hacking into the Austin, Texas-based SolarWinds, compromising its software distribution, and using it to infect the networks of customers who use SolarWinds network management software. In an online notice, however, Malwarebytes said the attackers used a different vector. While Malwarebytes, quote, does not use SolarWinds, we, like many other companies, were recently targeted by the same threat actor, the notice stated. We can confirm the existence of another intrusion vector that works by abusing applications with privileged access to Microsoft Office 365 and Azure environments. Now, investigators have determined that the attacker gained access to a limited subset of internal company emails. So far, they've found no evidence of unauthorized access or compromise in any Malwarebytes production environments. That being said, home users and enterprise admins alike with Malwarebytes in use should keep a close eye on this news item as it develops.
Now, you may be shoulders deep in DevOps, looking to find good DevOps people to hire, or even looking for services to help. What if I told you the professional role of DevOps might already be obsolete? Would you believe me? Well, bear with me for a second. Think about the recent evolution of services. And according to a recent study, 64% of organizations are pivoting their services or products to digital ones. Now, digital transformations are generating astronomical amounts of data that flows into IT teams. Now, DevOps practitioners are under tremendous pressure to improve customer impact and experience, but there may be too much data to handle. Now, how do you handle massive data amounts? Well, machine learning and AI, of course. Now, the traditional role of DevOps is putting out fires to keep the lights on, but we're shifting to new ways of working. Now, DevOps practitioners can leverage automation to reduce work and spend time working on innovative services and innovation on those services to provide a better overall customer experience. So basically, if you automate DevOps, you can focus on traditional but great IT person or service provider as it was before. Now, see how things come full circle? Well, that means that DevOps should and could evolve into what we call DevOps AI. Now, it would use AI to surface actionable information in production environments or throughout the development and delivery pipeline. Now, suppose you're surfacing actionable information through the entire software development lifecycle. In that case, it can reduce issues from getting to production in the first place. Plus, if issues do make their way to the wild, AI will get to work and help out there. We'll continue to surface the actionable information to enable automatic rollbacks or like code changes or even configuration changes. Now, we'll also optimize the environment or even modify it to the correct performance impact. The evolution will start with massive amounts of data and use intelligent observability. And AI will provide insights into what's normal and what's not. It can reduce customer-facing issues and the time to deploy new services. In fact, reducing disruptions ensures better customer satisfaction. In fact, AI could also impact the organizational structure of your job. Instead of the traditional corporate pyramids, additional trust can be given to practitioners to be more agile and innovate in new ways to actually improve automation. And by implementing improved solutions like intelligent observability, teams can achieve more. Now, this means that increased productivity and increased job satisfaction, but also because who doesn't like automating tedious tasks, repetitive tasks, right? Each day. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But before we get to those bites, we have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Worldwide Technology. Now, WWT began building their Advanced Technology Center 10 years ago, and it's been growing exponentially. It's like no other testing and research lab around. Now, the lab contains more than $500 million in equipment from hundreds of OEMs and key partners ranging from heavyweights like Dell Technologies, VMware, and Intel to emerging disruptors like Equinix. Now, WWT is a trusted partner who stays with you over the many years. Many of their customers have been with them for over a decade because they know WWT is where they can go to get the answers they need to make sure the business runs right. Their ATC is an incubator for IT innovation, and it offers on-demand and schedule labs like Dell's VxRail, PowerStore, Unity, PowerMax, Data Protection Central, and IDPA. Now, these labs represent the newest advances in primary storage. There are hundreds of labs to explore, including multi-cloud, hyper-converged infrastructure, networking, secondary storage, data analytics, AI, and more. Learn about products before you launch. WWT's engineers use these environments to quickly spin up proof of concepts and pilots using the ATC lab and environment so customers can confidently select the best solutions. In many cases, this reduces concept time from months to weeks, which increases speed to market. They offer lab as a service, a dedicated lab space within the ATC. Now, here customers can perform programmatic testing using the vast technology ecosystem that WWT has already built. And it's virtual, so you can take full advantage of the ATC's unique benefits anywhere in the world 24/7. WWT's engineers work in these labs every day, beta testing new equipment, building reference architectures and custom integrations to help their customers make decisions and see results faster and with much less investment. Now, WWT has launched a digital platform encompassing the ATC ecosystem. Now, this is an ever-evolving platform that creates a multiplier effect of knowledge, speed, and agility anytime, anywhere around the world for their customers and partners. Now, get full access to articles, case studies, hands-on labs, and other tools that make the difference in today's fast-paced world. To learn more about WWT, the ATC, and become a member of their growing community, go to WWT.com/twit to create an account and gain access to their on-demand labs today. WWT simplifies the complex. That's WWT.com/twit. WWT, delivering business and technology outcomes around the world. And we thank WWT for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the bites. Now, cyber threats, they can get scary. And when we hear more and more about them actually hitting public works and utilities, it can even scarier. In fact, a recent statement by Bill Gates says that one of the next disasters to hit us is actually bioterrorism. I want to add to that a list of cyber terrorism on the resources that we have. And I want to add to the to things like that. It may sound like a plot of a new movie, but according to Florida officials, someone broke into the computer system of a water treatment plant in Florida and tried to poison drinking water for Florida town with roughly 15,000 residents. Very interesting. Now, an unknown person remotely accessed a computer interface used to actually adjust the chemicals that treat drinking water for Oldsmar, a small city 16 miles northwest of Tampa. Now, the intruder changed the level of sodium hydroxide to 11,100 parts per million, a significant increase from the normal amount of 100 parts per million. Now, for those not familiar with sodium hydroxide, it's actually called lye. Now, it's used in small amounts to treat the acidity of water to actually remove remove metals. It's also the active ingredient in liquid drain cleaners. So at high levels, it's actually very toxic. Now, if gone undetected, the change in the solution to contain high levels would actually have raised the amount of chemical to toxic levels and potentially killed people. Now, both the FBI and Secret Service are investigating here, as well as the local authorities. Now, the first signs of the attack and the hack occurred on a Friday morning, and that's when a plant operator actually noticed someone remotely accessing the system that controls the chemicals and other aspects of the water treatment process. And then around 1:30 that same day, the operator actually watched as someone remotely accessed the system. They could see the mouse on his screen moving around the various functions that controlled the treatment process. In fact, the unknown person then opened the function that controlled the sodium hydroxide input and increased it by 111-fold. Now, the intrusion lasted for 3 to 5 minutes. In fact, the operator immediately changed the setting back to the standard 100 parts per million. Now, it takes 24 to 36 hours for treated water to hit the water supply system so that no poisonous water was actually released here. Now, I want to start the discussion on this. Should utilities really, or even other critical infrastructure systems and resources like that, be exposed to the internet? I want to throw it to you guys first. Curtis, I want to throw that to you.
Well, I think on the one hand, you can certainly make the argument that they should not be. On the other hand, there are some very real reasons that people do have them on the internet. Remote access by staff and engineers, remote access by consultants. So there are some very legitimate reasons to have this external access. The thing is, as we all know, if you're going to have something exposed to the internet at large, you need to have a heightened level of security on that connection. And heightened level of security was not something that seemed to be in play here. Now, I will say that Oldsmar is a very small town. We're talking about 15,000 people or so. So really small. I think the good piece of luck that happened here was that someone was watching the screens when the attack happened. Something that I'm sure they wouldn't tell you but would be interesting to know is just how much of the day no one's there at all. Now, the no one's there at all is why they want the internet access, but the idea that they have to count on a set of human eyes on the screen for critical redundancy is the sort of thing that, well, we'd like to think we were past in 2021.
Right. I agree. Yeah, I guess in this case, it was actually TeamViewer was the app used to remotely access the system. Now, this brings the next question, and Bam, I want to throw this to you. Why is TeamViewer on these systems? You have an operator sitting there, obviously, some of the day, and then you have a remote desktop or remote access application accessing a very critical system. That doesn't seem like the right configuration to me.
I would tend to agree. The first thought I had was rookie league mistake, right? The first thing your attackers scan for is, you know, escalated privilege type of services. So they're scanning for VNC, RDP, SSH, you know, Telnet even, you know, God forbid that something even that old and insecure is still running. So this is exactly what attackers scan for. They do a sweep for something that's going to easily get them directly to escalated privilege. So the fact that this was directly exposed tells me that their security controls are lax at best. I doubt there was MFA enabled on these accounts. There's probably reasons why they needed TeamViewer. So I'm not going to pretend to know their operational requirements, but there are ways to do what they did in a secure fashion, right? Remote access is a common requirement, especially to Curtis's point. If this is a small town, probably lightly staffed operational center, so you might need remote access in a pinch. There might be, you know, emergency reasons. You know, if that administrator falls asleep, or God forbid something worse happens to them while they're sitting in that chair, you need to be able to quickly get access to things that control critical infrastructure. So definitely can see a reason why TeamViewer would be on, or some other very privileged remote access solution be on board there. But there are a lot of really good ways, really well-defined ways that they could have cookbooked or followed a simple recipe and said, here's the secure way of doing this. And they clearly didn't do that. And that's worrisome at best.
Agreed. Yeah, I mean, I've worked with a lot of organizations, and a lot of them, just like you said, they use JIT admin access to machines. So, you know, if you really, really, really need to get on the machine, you have to, you know, authenticate yourself. You have to use systems like, you know, you have to use your YubiKey for to make sure that they know who you are. You have to use MFA to make sure that you're logging in correctly. And of course, then they audit the system, everything that you do, and they limit the what you can do depending on your persona or your role. So, you know, having full access, remote access of the box seems like overprivileged to me. So they're definitely not following the zero trust model. And in fact, we'll get into the zero trust model in the next bite. But, you know, that seems very strange to me that they were just giving complete access to the entire box. But, you know, Curtis, I want to throw the last word to you. Like, I think that this particular thing, I mean, obviously it's a small plant, a small city. It's probably run by, you know, the city, the local government. And, you know, they probably have a small force, probably a very small IT department. And so they thought, you know, like, no one's going to target us. We're going to keep this the way it is because it works. You know, the question begs to differ, though, is maybe there needs to be some policies that go into effect even for small towns that say, hey, you got to audit your systems and you have to make sure you're following these things, because eventually something really bad's going to happen.
Well, after all the discussions that we have had during the recent years about the fact that we know hackers have become persistent in many of our critical infrastructure networks, the idea that they would have the lax security on this water system that they had is remarkable. And by lax security, let me give you a picture. What we know so far is that there was no firewall in place between the open internet and this water treatment plant. And the team viewer that they were using was using default credentials. So it really was as simple as doing a Shodan scan and entering admin. That is just a horrible level of security. And to put it in perspective, I have better security on my bedroom television than they had on the water treatment system in Oldsmar, Florida. So should there be minimum requirements? Yes, there should be. In the same way, there should be best practices and minimum requirements on electric utilities, whether we're talking about a large regional or a small rural co-op. We should have the same sort of things on natural gas distribution systems, on sanitary sewage treatment systems. If you're dealing with systems that can directly impact public health and safety, there should be minimum requirements for cybersecurity best practices. I'm sorry that this happened. I'm glad, very happy that it was caught before any humans could be impacted. But this absolutely should be a wake-up call to utility operators across the country.
Agreed. Well, speaking of zero trust, because obviously they were not in the spirit of the model of zero trust for sure with this particular one, the next bite is talking about a little bit about the SolarWinds attack and just how it reinforces the concept of zero trust. Bam.
Yeah, so the SolarWinds attack really highlights not just zero trust, but one of the underlying concepts of zero trust is a policy of least privilege. So, and this can go a long way towards hardening you against such a compromise. SolarWinds attack is historic because it was multidimensional in sophistication. They continue to learn about new victims, techniques, and implications, and CISOs and security professionals are taking stock of their defense and depth strategies. One critical element in this principle of least privilege is based on what we've learned in the attack so far. There are some good lessons here. And for those of not familiar with principle of least privilege, just a quick primer from the NIST standards, and this is one of the 33 security principles that NIST outlines. And the concept of limiting access or least privilege is simply to provide no more authorizations than necessary to perform required functions. And this is perhaps most often applied in the administration of the system. Best practice suggests it is better to have several admins with limited access to security resources than one person with super user permissions. Now, this seems fairly obvious. However, in an activity alert published December 17th, the Department of Homeland Security's Cyber and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA, described how the Advanced Persistent Threat, or APT, behind SolarWinds used forged authentication tokens and credentials to highly privileged AD domain accounts as a persistence and escalation mechanism. In essence, this allows the actor to gain access to admin accounts and then add their own credentials to the existing service for elevated access to applications and data across the entire SolarWinds organization. So that one super user account quickly unlocks the rest of the organization and makes it much harder to find the bad actor. Now, based on this, there's three important lessons to think about and follow the principles of least privilege. One is working towards zero trust maturity. Really just audits of all your accounts and all your systems. What do you have that has these elevated privileges? You know, get a good inventory of what type of access is available. The SolarWinds APT took advantage of standing admin privileges once it established a foothold in the network to gain admin access. Reducing the number of users with these highly privileged roles down to zero is a good place to start. So getting that audit, finding out who has those access, getting that number down to zero, and distributing access in a least privileged fashion will help tremendously. Now, this alone is not zero trust. You've got to do a number of other things to, you know, everything down to network architecture and look at, you know, forcing privileges to be evaluated, granted or denied. And then you got to log and monitor everything, even when it is someone you trust and an account that you trust. Now, the second step, the second lesson here is consider humans and machines. Limiting access within an infrastructure should take humans and non-humans alike into consideration. SolarWinds really shined a light on one specific type of non-human activity, which is service accounts. And ex-NSA hacker Jake Williams astutely shared that in light of the attack, every organization should look to change its service account passwords. He also said most don't do this regularly or ever because, well, it's hard. Now, the interesting thing, SolarWinds was targeted because they have lots of service accounts that have access to everything because they have to monitor everything. And that's probably why Malwarebytes in my blip earlier was also targeted by these same nation state hackers, because they know that Malwarebytes has really pervasive access in a system. And then you really want to, you know, in the third part of this lesson is look at, you know, privilege at least or policy of least privilege in your production and design development. And, you know, really leveraging DevOps and automating the how accounts are managed and so on will enable you to give you insight into how to apply privilege policy of least privilege. So, you know, first thing I'm going to throw it to my friend Curtis. You know, back in the day, you know, and I'm just old enough to have been a Novell network administrator, but IBM mainframes, DEC minis, they all defaulted to this notion of privilege of least privilege. You know, what happened to those hard-earned lessons of the good old days of mainframes?
The short answer is economics happened. In those good old days, the hardware and software were in general the most valuable parts, or certainly the most expensive parts, of the IT infrastructure. And so you did what was required to defend them. Over time, the hardware and software have become relatively cheap. What hasn't become cheap? Human time. And therefore, we've taken to optimizing the impact of the human beings in the system. That means not making our admins go around logging into multiple accounts or getting single-use tokens for super-user privileges. We went ahead, gave them the privileges because it saved minutes. I think what needs to happen and what we're seeing more and more is the understanding of something that we've given lip service to for a while, and that is that data is the core asset of a business. Well, if data is the core asset, then data needs to be protected, and least privilege access is a good step towards that protection.
I couldn't agree more, Curtis. Lou, I want to throw it over to you now. And, you know, as someone who builds systems and software, we know that it's a lot easier to just give higher privileges so that we can test things, and that creating separate least privileges is a best practice. But can you talk to us a little bit about, you know, actually implementing this in real life and, you know, what it's like to build and test systems with principle least privilege on top of mind?
Yeah, I think anytime you develop a service, you know, whether it's, you know, running on a server or it's running on a workstation or whatever, you obviously need to build it that has the appropriate permissions of the system in order to gain the appropriate data it needs. So whether it's opening ports or it's, you know, that kind of thing. And so you want to develop the service that it uses, like you said, the least privileges it needs to do the job it needs to do. So if you're, even if you're testing, you know, you need to have a connection, but that connection needs to be from another testing box. You should only be opening that port, and you should only be securing that port to that other test box. You shouldn't be opening it for the wild for everyone to connect, or for every IP in the world to be able to get in there, or even, you know, putting a hole in a firewall or that kind of thing. So again, thinking about these things as you develop applications, and then also as you how you want your organizations to deploy them, as well as another thing is, you know, should they be deploying them by opening other areas of the service or the system to allow them to easily deploy them, or should they be deploying them physically on the box, or could they automate them, that kind of thing, rather than, you know, have these ports open or making them more vulnerable. So when you're developing them, I mean, we tend to think about these things. We tend to think about, okay, what steps we need to take, what privileges do we need to get them to be installed. And in order for the service to run or the application to run, how far and how much privilege do we need? In fact, we tend to write a lot of things in sandboxes today, which means they have no access to anything else other than what the admin allows them to have access to. And in fact, we will ask them, depending on as they configure the service, what they want allowed to have access and how long and what the policies are. And it even applies to some of the Windows policies as part of M365. So, you know, there's a lot to think about when you're developing applications and services today. And I'm not surprised some organizations who are not familiar with these enterprise concepts might not develop them in a way that have all the, you know, the bells and whistles and the different dials to turn in order to ensure that. So you're going to hear a lot more of these things, I'm sure, coming up.
Luke, that's a great insight and great advice. And I would love to spend another half hour on this topic because I'm getting really juiced up. I got about 18 more comments, but I think it's time to thank another one of our great sponsors and then get to our favorite part of the show, which is our guest.
Indeed, indeed. Thank you, Bam. Well, next up, we get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. Before we do, like Bam said, we do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that is Barracuda. Now, hackers are always looking for the weakest link in your security configuration, especially in your email security. Now, if you can find your vulnerabilities first, you can actually defend against cyber attacks. That's where Barracuda's new threat analyzer tool comes in. Now, from traditional malware to the latest spear phishing, account takeover, and conversation hijacking, Barracuda has identified 13 types of email threats. And the thing is, it takes several different layers of security working together to protect you efficiently against all 13 types. Now, suppose you're not fully protected. Cyber crooks are going to figure out where your vulnerabilities are. And in that case, it's literally what they spend all of their time on. Now, when they find the gap in your security, they need to choose the right threat type and customize it to get into your system. Now, that could actually end up costing millions of dollars for you and your reputation in the market. Now, here's where it gets hard. With hundreds of highly targeted personalized threat variants emerging daily and many different kinds of on-premises and cloud-based email systems, it can really be challenging to identify your specific gaps and vulnerabilities. I know, because I work for a lot of organizations and it really is challenging. That's where Barracuda's Threat Analyzer comes in and helps. It's incredibly simple and it's fast to use. Go to barracuda.com/enterprise and answer just a few multiple choice questions about your email security setup. It takes about 2 minutes. And the Barracuda Threat Analyzer provides a custom report telling you which threat types you're most vulnerable to. And you'll get a custom recommendation set on how to strengthen your defense against those attacks. It's free and it's very, very easy to use. Now, Barracuda's December spear phishing report found 12% of all spear phishing attacks are actually business email compromise. That's up 7% since 2019. And that kind of growth shows how successful these attacks can be. In fact, you know, I've actually seen cases where, you know, emails have come in and, you know, people look at them because they're topics that really can really relate to, such as, you know, the World Health Organization around COVID or vaccine distribution. And so it creates a lot of ambiguity and it causes them to, you know, want to click on them, want to see what's going on. And that's where you gain your weakest link. Now, according to the FBI's most recent internet crime report, business email compromise attacks led to over $3.5 billion in loss. Now, the government of Puerto Rico lost $2.6 million in a single attack last year. Now, even Shark Tank's Barbara Cochran fell one of these attacks last year herself. Her emails fell for an impersonation attack and paid a fake invoice wiring almost $400,000. Now, they were lucky enough to realize what they had done in time to recover the money. Now, Manor Independent School District in Texas wasn't as lucky. They made a fraudulent payment over a whole month, losing $2.3 million before the attack was discovered. Now, does your email security protect against those attacks? try the Barracuda Threat Analyzer today for free and get a full report showing exactly what you need to do to secure your email. Go to Barracuda.com/enterprise to find out where your hidden threats lie. That's the Barracuda Threat Analyzer at Barracuda.com/enterprise. And we thank Barracuda for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's my favorite part of the show where you actually get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twilight Riot. And today we have Senior Manager of Product Marketing of AppDynamics, Shreyans Parekh. Welcome to the show, Shreyans.
Thank you for having me, Lou.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, our audience loves to hear people's origin stories. Can you maybe take us through a short journey through tech and what brought you to AppDynamics?
Sure. So my journey through tech has really come about through the lens of working with tech companies firsthand in my early career, which was in investment banking, focused on tech, media, and telecom companies of all sizes, but really in the mid-market breadth, as well as working with companies to on various strategies of going public, as well as how to expand via their liquidity offerings. And what I realized was that the operational experience in working with executives was really what I wanted to gain. And so that's what brought me into the enterprise technology world, specifically working with companies on their corporate strategy initiatives, long-range planning, product roadmap planning. And most what I love most in my role is speaking with customers firsthand, day in and day out, about ways that companies like AppDynamics, as well as our partner ecosystem, can help them in their digital transformation journeys.
That's fantastic. Yeah, I love to talk to customers too, because it really gives you that real world scenario based feedback loop. First, I want to maybe talk about the elephant in the room for some organizations, that separation of concerns between application and infrastructure teams. Now, one develops applications, and some using cloud native technologies, and the other deploys, hosts, scales, and secures those applications. There can sometimes be significant churn between those groups sometimes. What are you seeing when you've obviously worked with a lot of organizations? What are you seeing from those two groups? Are they working together? Are they working against each other? And how are those organizations handling them?
Sure. So I think the role of the IT operations and development teams working hand in hand has really matured and evolved, especially over the last decade that I have been focused on and the enterprise technology space. I think that the traditional paths of developers shipping over code to IT operations teams and then sort of, you know, washing their hands of any issues that may arise, or saying, that it's now the IT operations team's decision and path going forward. And there being very little communication between the two teams, as well as the disparate platforms that are being used. Those days are now, luckily behind us in most of the enterprise organizations that I have worked with. There are enterprises that are, of course, on different varying degrees of their maturity path. We talked about earlier in the show today about DevOps and DevOps AI. And I think that AI and ML have certainly assisted in taking enterprises and really accelerating their growth on this maturity curve. And now with really robust DevOps teams, and now also with the advent of DevSecOps teams, including security professionals as well, firsthand, that I feel that many enterprises are now on the right path towards exploring their future initiatives, whether that be moving to the cloud, evaluating and utilizing cloud native technologies, such as containers and other protocols for open source. So there's a lot of really good trends and trending in the positive direction that I see between developer and IT operations teams.
That's great. Yeah, I think that's true. I think there's a lot of monitoring systems and tools that could be used between these two. But like you said, a lot of these cloud native infrastructures and technologies like containers and so on and so forth, it does create a little bit more complexity. And then it also means that there's more data flowing in to these teams to be able to handle. So, obviously, an application is only as good as the place it's hosted on. What are some teams doing? What's some organizations doing to monitor, to kind of like have data and share data between those two different teams and those two different groups?
Sure. So what a lot of organizations are doing now is this notion of observability has really come to the forefront over the last few years. And here at AppDynamics, for instance, what we provide is the platform for business observability. In working alongside our enterprise teams, we find that teams really want a single source of truth where both the developer and IT operations teams, and now the third component, which is, you know, what I mentioned, security professionals, they can all come together, coalesce around a single platform view so that they're not using, in many times, you know, upwards of 10, 15 different tools in their DevOps ecosystems, in their CI/CD pipelines to be able to monitor and not just monitor at their applications, but actually gain actionable insights, which will take them to the next step and actually help them in facilitating things like troubleshooting or optimization, whether it's optimization on the front end, on the back end, or any parts of their infrastructure or technology stack. And so that holistic view from business to user experience to application to infrastructure to network and finally security. That is what the platform for business observability provides, and we've gotten a tremendous amount of positive response from a lot of the developer and IT operations teams that we've been working with.
Right. So, you know, I find it interesting. A lot of organizations have legacy, you know, processes, legacy systems that they do for things. Obviously, they handle case management in a particular way. You know, you mentioned AppDynamics and how it can integrate. Does it integrate with some of these systems and some of the current business operations that are happening in an organization?
It definitely does. So AppDynamics, as you know, is part of the Cisco ecosystem. We were acquired by Cisco in 2017. And alongside Cisco, we are actually now working with a broad global partner set. So a lot of the use cases that you've mentioned, including companies that we work with to enhance our platform for business observability and provide really seamless integration across the board. And so when we're going into current customers, when we're going into net new prospects, we really want to be able to show the value in their current ecosystem. We don't intend to make large sweeping changes in their ecosystem from the start. We really want to work alongside them and partner with a lot of the different technology applications and vendors that they're using right now.
Right. So let me ask you a question. If they're not, let's say they're not partnering, is there a way for, other systems to feed data into AppDynamics in some way? Do they use some kind of standard, messaging, logging, that kind of thing? Or does it have to be a partner and it has to set up some kind of integration?
No. So, well, you know, we have a number of different types of relationships in place. We have our technology ISV partners that are in place. We have on the business side, vendors and partners and channel alliances that actually help us to seed our products into various organizations and show the value. And so it is not required at all to be a official partner in the AppDynamics and Cisco ecosystem. We are able to, you know, the approach that we take to monitoring and holistic monitoring is to be able to seamlessly feed in other types of vendors that may fill in specific holes that our customers and prospects, you know, have within their organizations to provide that full end-to-end observability. And so we encourage, you know, if technology partners who, you know, have been working with Cisco and AppDynamics for years to be able to work with our accounts, but we also love to work with integration partners that we may not have an official relationship with yet.
Got it. So, you know, I've seen a lot of organizations. I work with a lot of organizations that tend to have these hybrid clouds. They use different providers. They have some high on-prem. They have, you know, some Azure, some AWS kind of set up. How does AppDynamics work between or work with a hybrid type situation type infrastructure?
Certainly. And so AppDynamics works with organizations of all in all stages of maturity. So companies that are moving to the cloud, taking one of several approaches in their cloud migration approach, companies that are either hybrid cloud in approach and very much want to see a certain applications that are and workloads that are still hosted on premises, and others that are that may be deployed on a single public cloud, potentially using a public and private cloud offering. And so there are many different permutations of companies that are developing their applications and utilizing cloud services for their workloads and to optimize their workloads. And then on the other end of the spectrum, there are companies that are entirely cloud native as well. And so we are working heavily alongside those companies. And it's really a symbiotic relationship because they're in our engineering teams working together, they're really pushing the limits of where we're taking our technology. And we are grateful for that because of all of the new, as you are certainly aware of, all of the new advances that are coming out in cloud technology that are quite frequent and abundant.
Right. Well, I do want to bring my co-host back in because I am sure that they're probably thinking, especially Mr. Brian McHenry, thinking about a little bit about security. Bam?
Well, AppDynamics is most well known for being able to spot performance issues before they become serious problems, right? I think that's what we all think of when we think of AppDynamics and what they're best at and what they've set the market for. But I'm a security guy. There's no keeping that out of my head. And but what I do know is that performance trends and performance data and analytics often foretell or signal that there's a security problem either about to happen or has already happened. Could you talk a little bit about the security use cases and solutions that AppDynamics has that maybe some of our listeners don't know about?
Sure. Definitely. That security is always top of mind for us, Brian. And what we see today is that business and digital strategies have really converged, meaning that the application is now the business. And AppDynamics and Cisco very recently announced the Secure Application, which is the industry's first application-led security product that will simplify vulnerability management and help businesses defend against attacks and protect applications from the inside out. And so what we're doing is we're connecting application security teams through a single solution, you know, as I mentioned, with DevSecOps now sort of bridging the gap between these historically siloed teams for everything from quick remediation when vulnerabilities are detected, as well as proactive optimization of systems. So not just taking a firefighting troubleshooting approach, but actually proactively looking at ways in which the system is vulnerable and being able to, through AI and ML, support a enhanced system of record for the business and digital strategy. Now, the analogy that I like to often give is it's almost like the application is like a museum with very extravagant art and jewelry inside. Secure application is like moving the security guards from the outside of the museum, which AppDynamics has historically offered, to now guarding every single item within that museum. So it's almost like creating a secure barrier across all of the high-end art, all of the sculptures, the jewelry that exists in this museum, that is your company and application set.
Thank you. I want to bring Curtis in as well. Curtis?
Well, I have a number of questions. So let's start at, as the song says, let's start at the very beginning. When you are going in and doing your initial observation and your initial creation of inventory lists for a customer, how often are they surprised by what you're seeing? I know that a few years ago, I was talking to people who were always telling me that, you know, they were finding infrastructure, especially cloud infrastructure, that was perhaps an order of magnitude bigger than what the CISO thought was part of the company inventory. Are you still finding that there's this disconnect when you go into client sites between what they think is in their inventory and what's actually there?
Absolutely, Kurt, and that exists still today. Actually, with a lot of the enterprise, even though you know many companies have been utilizing AppDynamics for several years, so it's really the breadth of companies that have been utilizing us for some time, and companies that are looking at AppDynamics and implementing business observability into their ecosystem for the first time. So the analogy that I often like to give is when you look at the flow map view of your application end to end and all of the different services that they're interacting with in cloud infrastructures. It could be a multi-cloud infrastructure, again, where public and private cloud settings, as well as some of the legacy, you know, on-premises mainframe activity that might be happening. It's almost like turning on the lights in a dark room and seeing a lot of the detail that you had envisioned in your mind potentially being there, but it's not until you turn on the light where you're actually able to see the color, see the texture behind some of these items within the room itself. And then you're able to tackle and organize the room within your liking. And so similarly in these environments, it's such that with our out-of-the-box views that we provide, again, the flow map view, fully out-of-the-box, which provides a full topology of your full technology stack, and most recently, the cloud-native visualization, which provides a deeper view into all of your cloud-native technologies, so many of which which we mentioned already today. And so that's what we're excited to provide, and I enjoy seeing that reaction. Many times from everyone from, you know, practitioner level all the way to CISOs.
Well, you know, I can see where that would be an exciting thing to see. And I'd like to get a little bit into some detail because when you're providing this, you know, you've been talking about DevOps and DevSecOps. Are you looking at providing dev groups and security groups with things like a picture of how policies are being put into practice on pieces of infrastructure and around software components? Or are you, for example, showing them where least privilege might exist or not in particular pieces of the development infrastructure? You know, who really is going to be part of what you are observing, and who's going to be seeing the dashboard that results from that?
Right. And, you know, the dashboard view that we provide, I'll get started with that, Kurt, because the dashboard is a very critical piece of our overall offering. We often want the company that we're working with to be able to deploy various levels of dashboards and to be able to gather up and act on several insights that are taking place within the organization. And so everyone from practitioners who are utilizing our secure application product all the way to business decision makers within the organization, it could be a general manager or a product manager within your organization, all the way up to the CTO and CISO of your organization. Because with different levels of view pertaining to different use cases as well as needs within the organization. It could be how do vulnerabilities and attacks, how are they affecting revenue in real time? How are they affecting the performance of specific applications in real time, which then feed back into the business? So it's always about tying the application to the underlying security infrastructure and the business. And now to your earlier part of your question, around how do we provide that view? It's really around protecting the organization and users from attacks and vulnerabilities with unified business performance and security observability. And now this view will provide applications from the inside out. Traditionally, it's been looking at applications from the outside and seeing what are the effects of various matters, everything pertaining to network resilience, to cloud infrastructure services, to front-end performance. So it's always taking an outside in view this is actually flipping that paradigm and protecting the applications from the inside out. So from mainframes to microservices, our Cisco secure application is able to detect threats continuously and defend your business against attacks in real time. And this is the first time that an enterprise-grade solution like this has existed, which provides that that deep level of view from the inside out.
Well, folks, all things must come to an end at some point. Cheyenne, thank you so much for being here. We're running a little bit low on time, but I did want to give you a chance to maybe tell the folks at home where they can go to learn more about AppDynamics and maybe how they can get started.
Sure, absolutely. And so AppDynamics, as easy as visiting appdynamics.com. For any immediate questions that you can have, you can certainly enter them into our chat bot. And we can, you know, get everything from a custom demo set up, link you with the right professionals to answer any deeper dive technology questions that you have. And then we can continue the relationship in that way. But you can go to appdynamics.com and submit your request for a custom demo and for professionals to contact you directly.
Fantastic. Thanks again. Well, folks, you've done it again. You sat through another Have the Best Thing Enterprise podcast in the universe. So tune your podcatcher to Dwight. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-host, starting with Mr. Brian McHenry. Bam, what's going on for you in the coming week, and where can people find you and all your work at F5?
Well, you can find me at BA McHenry on Twitter, but we're celebrating 25 years at F5. So we were founded way back in 1996, and I've been here at F5 for just about 13 years of those 25. So just wanted to share with all the folks out there, if you're interested in F5 technology and interested in learning more, we're our customer event Agility. We just announced the dates this week as part of our 25th anniversary, and that's April 20th to 22nd. It'll be a virtual event again this year. And we're looking forward to delivering the best hands-on labs, the best breakout sessions. So you can go head over to f5.com/agility and register to be notified as soon as registration is open. So you can make sure and get your seats and all the sessions you want to be in. So we're really excited about Agility once again this year. We learned a lot about delivering a virtual event last year, and we expect it's going to be even better this year.
Fantastic. Thank you, Ben. Well, we also have to thank Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, what's going on for you in the coming week? Where can people find you and all your work?
Well, I'm talking to a lot of companies looking at DevSecOps, looking at enterprise security management, just finding out all sorts of cool things. I have some pieces coming out that you can find over at Dark Reading in the Omdia tab. And as always, feel free to follow me on Twitter at KG4GWA or Instagram at Kurt_Franklin. Also planning to get some things going over on LinkedIn. So if you want to follow me there, I'm Curtis Franklin on LinkedIn. Feel free to do something. Would love to be able to share some of my thoughts with you over there.
Thank you, Kurt. Well, even though he's isn't a co-host today, he's always our tireless producer, and he's been the happy traveler as well. And now he's the new resident of the Sunshine State. Cheebert, there, you made it. There he is.
Here he is.
I'm alive. Well, kind of, after two very long plane rides.
Do they make you actually do a test before you got off the plane in the Orlando area?
Did they make you do a test before you got on the plane or before you got off the plane?
No, I did the test before I got on the plane, but the airline didn't require it. But I wanted to make sure we weren't dragging any kind of nastiness to our friends Kurt and Carol.
And we're grateful.
That's a good thing. It's a good thing. Great to see you, Cheebert. Good luck with everything. Well, folks, thanks to you as well. You're the person who drops in each and every week to watch and to listen to our show to get your enterprise goodness. And we want to make it easy for you to watch and listen to our show. So go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twyatt. There you'll find all of our amazing back episodes, information about the shows, the co-hosts, the guests, and all the links we do during the show. But also More importantly, next to those videos there, you'll get those helpful subscribe and download links. Click on the audio version or video version of your choice. Listen on any one of your devices or any one of your podcast applications, because we're on all of them. You know, definitely subscribe, because it's really the best way to stay on top of your enterprise and IT news, and it's really the best way to support the show as well. Now, after you subscribe, go ahead, impress your friends, your family, your coworkers. Give them the gift of TWiBE, because we talk about a lot of fun topics on the show, and I can guarantee they will find them fun as well. So definitely share it with them. Now, if you already subscribed and you're available 1:30 p.m. Pacific time on Fridays, we do this show live. You can check it out at live.twit.tv. There we have, you know, all the back behind the scenes. We show you how the pizza's made, basically. We have some good banter and so on before the show. So definitely check us out live at live.tv. And of course, if you're going to watch the show live, you might as well jump into the amazing chat room live as well. I have them always right here on my screen. It's irc.twit.tv. They have some amazing characters in there. They ask some great questions. They give some great content. So definitely be part of the chat room as well. Now, if you can't watch the show live, but you still want to be part of the conversation and the community, that's okay, because we have a great place for you to go. Twit.community. It's a new website. It's available 24/7 for 24/7 discussion. And a lot of people are out there. There's the Twit communities out there. All the hosts are out there. We talk about each show. We have some really great conversations about the topics of the show and just technology in general. So definitely check it out and be part of the community, Twit.community. Now, remember, you can always follow me at twitter.com/LouMM. There I post all of my amazing enterprise tidbits of the week. Plus, I have great conversations with people like you. So definitely come out and subscribe and follow me as well. Plus, I also post a little bit about my normal work week at Microsoft. Just a little bit about developers.office or developers.microsoft.com/office, where how we can make your office suite more productive for you and your organization. So definitely check it out and see how we can help you. I do want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support This Week in Enterprise Tech each and every week, and we couldn't do the show without them. So thank you so much for their support over the years. I also want to thank all the staff and the Twit engineers as well. Thank you for all their support. And of course, before we sign out, we have to thank our editor behind the scenes, Mr. Victor. He's, he makes us look good. She just does. He takes out all the hard parts of the show. So thanks, Victor, for all your support. And of course, our TD for today, Mr. Ant Pruitt. Ant, what's going on for you in the coming weeks? And what's going on over there at Twit?
I've been having a lot of fun playing around with a lot of different amazing tech, including a couple different cameras. Had another camera delivered today. So subscribe to my show, Hands On Photography, twit.tv/hop, as well as Hands On Tech, twit.tv/hot.
Fantastic. Thank you, Ant. Well, until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.
Hey, folks, I'm Ant Pruitt, host of Hands of Photography here on Twit TV. I know some of you have gotten yourself a brand new camera, or you just had a camera sitting around and can't quite figure out how to get the most out of it. Well, I have a solution. My show, Hands On Photography. So subscribe right now to learn how to get the most out of that camera. I'm going to show you how to make those images pop. I don't care if it's a Canon camera. I don't care if it's a Sony, Nikon, iPhone, Android, even an inexpensive Android device. I got you covered. So head on over to twit.tv/hop and subscribe today.